As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here alone because Derek got lost in the wind. But we are very excited, I am very excited to welcome to the podcast today, Ross Bennis. Ross is a journalist and author of 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. So, Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
So let's start with a question. What made you want to write about 1999? I remember 1999. I was 14 for most of it. Woodstock 99, everyone always talks about. Everyone talks about how it's basically one of the great years in movie history. But this book, you decide to focus on what might be lovingly termed trash culture. Jerry Springer, Insane Clown Posse, Vince McMahon. And it looks like this is Sonya Blade on the cover of
That's right.
Of the book of Mortal Kombat fame. So why 1999? What led you to write about this year in particular?
Well, there's been a lot of things in the last 6 to 8 years that have reminded me of the trashy stuff that I grew up with as a kid. So like if I'd see senators threaten to fight each other in a congressional hearing, I was like, that's Jerry Springer coming to Congress, you know? God, everything Trump does is some sort of kayfabe from WWE. NFTs reminded me a lot of Beanie Babies. So there were enough of these moments that I went back and like re-examined all the trashy stuff I liked as a kid. And I chose 99 the year because that was the year out of all of them that everything was the nuttiest. You know, in addition to Woodstock 99, you have Beanie Babies getting retired, porn stars trying to set records by having sex with as many people as possible. Everything around the New Year's Eve that year, you know, it was pretty nutty. So you could write a similar book on like 96 or even 2001, but the insanity in 99 is a little heightened compared to the rest of the 90s.
So what do you think was coming together in those years? We'll talk about the individual things, but why 1999? Or what do you think was happening in the late 1990s, pre-2000, 2001? As listeners know, we just had Colette Shade on, and she kind of takes this period as, you know, she calls it Y2K. But how would you say 1999 fits into that larger story of culture, or even what Colette was saying? And how do you think it's different from either what we remember or what it's come to symbolize in culture? Or do we remember it correctly that it's just like fucking insane year and that's about it?
Well, there was a lot of media deregulation at the time. So my point is that this trashy stuff was super popular, like Jerry Springer wrestling, Insane Clown Posse, all these things peaked in the 90s. And there was a lot of entertainment aimed at young people, especially young men. And it was made as cheaply as possible. So like lowest common denominator stuff was made at unprecedented levels due to a series of media deregulations that produced giant companies that are just aiming to have a cheap hit at all costs. Reality TV certainly factors in there as well. And I'm not saying that to downgrade or mock any of this stuff. Like I like Jerry Springer. I listened to the Amazing Jekyll Brothers back in 99. I am a fan of the trash, but it's 99 is written out a lot about like the Sopranos and the great movies and all this like really renowned pop culture. But my point is if you look at it, you'd see due to the emergence of the internet, more cable TV stations existing than before, and cable is still gaining popularity at the time. And then you have few companies controlling our mass media. All those factors contribute to a huge glut of trash that resonated with people and was very profitable. All this stuff, you know, if it's made cheaply and it reaches a lot of people, it's good for the bottom line of a Viacom, CBS, or Disney, or, you know, any of these companies that were just getting bigger and bigger due to all the ownership restrictions being eliminated throughout the 80s and 90s.
So what do you see as the explicit connection between the emergence of a trash culture and sort of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, this long, slow deregulation of the television industry that occurs over the course of the 80s and into the 90s? How is that actually related to, you know, CBS, Viacom becoming gigantic, Disney, ABC, Capital Cities becoming gigantic? What do you see as the connection there? You think if these companies didn't merge, they wouldn't have embraced this type of culture? How does that merging contribute to this?
Well, there wouldn't be as much pressure to embrace that type of culture. There wouldn't have quite the pressure to produce, you know, hits as cheaply as possible. Because really all the low culture is produced fairly cheap, aside from video games. But video games are viewed more as low culture just because they're condemned in the 90s, maybe not today. So if you take the Telecommunications Act of 96 and some of these other bills that happened throughout the 90s, you know, you're lifting caps on the number of stations that a single place can own. So like you're eliminating the divisions between, you know, a telecom can own a cable company could be a phone operator, film studios can now be owned by TV networks and so on and so forth. What it allows to do when those companies are so big is to make a cross media superstar out of someone who would have not been able to do so otherwise. So like if you take Howard Stern, due to the merger of CBS and Viacom, Stern had his book, movie, TV show, radio show, all produced by one company and distributed by one company.
Private Parts, Shasta McNasty, and the Howard Stern Show, right? Or did I get Shasta McNasty correct? Yeah.
Well, and he had Son of the Beach?
Yeah, Son of the Beach. And he also had the E Show where they would.
Yeah, that was a little bit later, but same sort of thing. Well, and his radio show is syndicated on E. So, like, one of his TV shows is just his radio show, but broadcast. But they have the power to do that in a way that like would have been harder to obtain before. And this works with all those teen stars. Like think of what Disney did for like all those teen stars. They could just take a person and, you know, push them out broadly, make them a hit across all these different media. And that's easier for a giant corporation to do due to, you know, Telecommunications Act and these other deregulations. Before, like that would have been, those would have all been separate companies. Like Stern's radio station would have been like a separate company from you know, the TV studio would have been a separate company from the video rental, because like you could go and rent all this shit on Blockbuster. So it's like a, you could call it corporate synergy, but I just say it's like huge media companies getting bigger and realizing that like it's in their best interest to produce reality TV rather than, you know, a bunch of prestige TV.
Let's actually move into that. Let's talk about Jerry Springer. And in particular, let's talk about the rise of talk shows and where you trace the origins of Jerry Springer to, and how Springer, and you could talk about who he is, became the icon that he wound up becoming.
Well, Jerry Springer, I would say he's following the lead of Geraldo Rivera, but Springer takes it to new heights or to new lowlights, if
maybe
you will.
Maybe for the kids, who is Geraldo Rivera? He's most famous for Al Capone's Vault, but who was he and how did he lead to Springer?
Yeah, so Geraldo Rivera, he's worn a lot of different hats throughout his career, but he was a former journalist at the time, or at least you could call him a TV broadcaster, who gets his own syndicated special, and he starts to become a little tabloid with the Al Capone Vault special. So he produces this series that's distributed in 181 TV stations where viewers are going to find out what lies in this old Chicago building that Al Capone used to own, and they spend 2.5 hours, most of it's pre-recorded, interviewing people cosplaying as gangsters and antiques experts and ammunition experts. So there's nothing in the fucking vault. It's just an empty vault. And that should have like ruined him, but instead it made him a superstar because so many people came in to watch. It didn't matter that there was nothing in the vault. The fact that he got people's attention and he got them to tune in to see what was in it led him to get this TV deal. So he had a talk show, and he was the first talk show that, like, there were some fights in the Geraldo Rivera show. Not as often as Jerry Springer, but every once in a while you would have like, there's a famous one where black rights activists are fighting neo-Nazis, or maybe they're KKK. I can't remember. There's some sort of white supremacist group. Rivera has them fight and he gets his nose bloodied in the shot. And that episode becomes like the most famous episode of the daytime talk at the time. And his ratings were huge. He would talk about Satanism. You know, he was very much alarmist. He was a part of the satanic panic, like telling people that like your teens are into, you know, satanic worship and all this crazy stuff if they are doing anything that teens normally do, like being alone and listening to music and not wanting to, you know, respect their parents. So Rivera, like I say, provides the template for what Jerry Springer would do. Jerry Springer started out as a serious talk show in the 90s, but there were dozens of talk shows because at the time you still had regulations kind of separating talk shows from their owner, because that's why they're syndicated, because TV networks couldn't produce their own, they couldn't produce most of their own programming and own it. They would have to license it. That was part of the financial syndication rules that were repealed in the early 90s. So one way to get cheap programming is to go through these syndicated companies that are trying to sell you talk shows. And Springer is one of like a dozen. You know, there's Richard Bay and Ricky Lake and Maury and Oprah, Donahue. There's just tons of these. And he's trying to be serious because he was a serious politician. He was Cincinnati mayor. He ran for Ohio governor. He was Cincinnati city council. He was a progressive. Springer was actually like pretty left-leaning. He cared about homelessness and all these education, all these like serious issues. And that's what he wanted to do on his talk show, is talk about the issues. But talking about gun control with Oliver North did not produce ratings. People hated it. So they went crazy to get ratings. They said, let's do whatever the hell, you know, you want to do. And suddenly you're not talking about teen homelessness. You're talking about some young girl sleeping with their stepfather and, you know, mutated love triangles and adults wearing diapers, all sorts of crazy shit. And so he's taking like the Geraldo Rivera template of like sensationalism, like Satanism and fights, but he's just doing it to a crazier level. And he's handsomely rewarded. Becomes the most watched daytime talk show. He overtakes Oprah. Other shows mimic his style. They become more combative, more sensational. And, you know, it gives birth to reality TV, really. Like the way that all the Housewives and the Vanderpump Rules cast fight with each other and have these like choreographed disagreements. It's very much Jerry Springer. So he's like with us, even though daytime talk shows aren't shit now.
Let's talk about the reality TV. How does reality TV come to be? There's precursors like the 7-Up series, the British documentary that follows the same people over the course of 7 years. Obviously, documentary itself is a form. The Real World, I think, is generally pointed to as the modern one, but there are precursors. Yeah. Where I know in Britain where you like follow a family for a year. So what makes the instantiation of quote unquote reality television that comes to dominate in 1999 unique? So it emerges from the talk shows, but what else is there, do you think?
Well, I would agree with you that the Real World's really the first like forerunner of what we're talking about for reality shows, even though there were ones before. What happens in the late 90s, you know, I would target 99, but I'd say basically 98 to 2001, is all the broadcast networks get into reality TV in a big way. So there was reality shows on cable, especially on MTV with Real World and Road Rules, but CBS, NBC, ABC weren't doing much of this programming. But when, you know, you have the repeal of the financial syndication rules, so TV networks can suddenly own their own primetime programming and produce their own primetime programming, and there's no separation. They don't have to be any separation between the network and the studio producing the content. You have that, and then you have all these other mergers happening. So like CBS, for instance, takes the formula now that they can do it themselves and own their own programming, they see what's working on MTV and they release The Amazing Race, Big Brother, Survivor. You know, those are all like 99 to 01 coming out. That makes this go into a whole new level. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was actually the most watched show, like on network television in 1999. It's on ABC. I know it's more of a game show, but you're definitely seeing the broadcast networks trying to use cheap programming as much as possible. And these shows are all hits. So after Millionaire and Survivor and Big Brother are hits, then you just see like dozens of these shows, and it's an onslaught, and it doesn't really stop.
Well, what is the affect of these shows, and how do you think that you say that it leads to modern politics or foreshadows it? So what do you mean by that, and what are the actual affect of these reality shows? Big Brother, if I recall, was actually initially a UK show, so yep. You see this borrowing, which becomes very big as American media essentially outsources a lot of its reality TV IP generation, interestingly enough, not totally, but a lot. But what defines these shows?
Well, generally what defines them is they, at least initially, now there's a lot less division, but initially it's like you have ordinary people starring in primetime programming as cast members, and they're, you know, they're on the show as contestants. They're not famous already. So like that's where you get, you know, start to get the term famous for being famous. This starts to become a meaningless distinction once you have celeb reality shows where people are already famous doing reality shows. But you know, the 2000 season of Survivor, no one knew who those people were before, but they are going to get famous. Like Richard Hatch becomes famous because he won Survivor, not because of anything else he did. And people who start in reality then, you know, go and make it in other areas, whether it's entertainment or politics. The biggest effect, though, with it in politics is clearly Donald Trump starring in The Apprentice and using that to springboard himself to become more of an international star beyond just like the New York tabloids, you know, really made him the icon he became.
What do you think about the presentation, actually, for
it's not pretentious at all. And there's always a confrontation happening, like whether or not that would actually naturally happen in the course of those people interacting with each other. The producers edit and design reality shows so that there are confrontations between cast members. People can't get enough of the confrontations. So like the real world from season one to like season six changes a ton. It starts out like people are talking about high-minded concepts and like socio-political issues and sharing their true found feelings. And then it's just young, hot people arguing with each other and making out in hot tubs by 2005. And that's that gets better viewership. Like people want that. They want the shock and the sensation. And so a lot of how our like senators interact with each other, especially on Twitter, but even like if they're on the floor of the Senate, it's like the Real Housewives in New York. Like they're shooting for the confrontation. It's not like a natural conversation that you would have between two genuine people. It's to shock and grab your attention and to get you on one side versus the other. You know, reality TV was really good at like pitting a villain. They would find a villain for the season.
So why do you think that is? Some people would just say, you know, it's human nature. We like purience. or do you think there's something more going on there?
It's easier to just tell a story and have like a coherent narrative if you have someone that you're rallying against or something that you're rallying against. If you have, you know, like an asshole incarnate, is like some of the people who play up themselves to be the reality TV villain. Of course, now in our national politics, no one has to play that up. We have enough of those guys who are just there. Yeah,
doing it on their own. So let's move on to Beanie Babies and Pokemon. And you claim that these two embody capitalism. But maybe you could, for people who might not know, you could remind them, what were Beanie Babies? I mean, that's basically my stock portfolio, so I wasn't so glad to read this chapter. But what are Beanie Babies? What are Pokemon? Where do they come from? And then basically, how do you think that they embody capitalism, or at least the capitalism that was ascendant in the 90s and beyond?
Well, so I'll start with Beanie Babies, and they were... God, that was a big craze. If you guys weren't around for them in the 90s, they were just stuffed animals, basically little plushies with pellets in them that you could buy for $5 at your local pharmacy. But there was this demand for them and this belief that certain Beanie Babies were scarce enough that people would pay $10,000 for the Princess Diana one, or $5,000 for some rare bear. So people were... There were robberies over Beanie Babies. There was a murder. There were couples who would go to court to divide their assets, and Beanie Babies would be one of the things they'd be forced to divide because they believed that, like, they had $50,000 worth of Beanie Babies, even though it was just a few sacks full of worthless stuffed animals, and they'd be forced to take turns picking them right there in the courtroom. So it's just crazy what lengths people went to get them, but they weren't really valuable. They weren't scarce. Tai Inc. just convinced people that there was worth in them, and that belonging to this community of collectors was something that you just had to do. So a lot of people put a lot of their hard-earned money into this, only to see the market fully collapse. Like, things, you know, toys worth thousands of dollars being worth $10 again over the course of, you know, less than a year. So it was a huge pop. And to me, that was reflecting the excesses of capitalism at that very time. Because you had the dot-com bubble happening at the same time as the Beanie Babies. A lot of irrationality in the market. You know, internet startups that didn't even exist 3 months prior would get millions in funding, have crazy evaluations, be on the Super Bowl, and then not even be existing as a company like a year later. That happened so often. Of course, from the dot-com bubble, you had a few big winners. You know, there are companies like eBay and Amazon that are still around in a big way who went through all that. But God, you saw people just doing crazy shit. I give you one example. Palm Pilot, the little handheld devices. There was a moment where their subsidiary that was a dot-com was worth like triple the value of their parent company. So if you did the math, it was like the parent company of Palm had to be worth a negative, like, I don't know what it was, like $8 billion for this to make sense. Like, there had to be negative worth on the parent company because the valuations between the internet startup subsidiary and the parent just like didn't align. There's no rationality in this. People are just putting money down, hoping that they'll strike it rich. And a few people did. So
I just have a question about that, because obviously booms and busts are endemic to capitalism. You think back to the famous tulip bubble in the Netherlands in the early modern period, and this is one of the major things that economists have been trying to study throughout the 19th and 20th century, how to basically tame the boom-bust cycle. What do you think was particular about the 90s, and really, like, why Beanie Babies? You know, you could put your... To me, it's almost something like working class and lower middle class people are trying to get rich by purchasing not especially expensive items, and then maybe because they can't really play the stock market in the same way as the upper middle class. So I'm just curious, what do you think is the specificity of the Beanie Baby at this moment?
Well, that's an interesting parallel you make. And Zach Bissonette, who wrote the Beanie Baby book, basically it says that as well, that like Beanie Babies were the low culture stock investments for that generation. Like, the institutional investors are buying the dot-coms. You know, the mom and pops that want to get in on a craze are buying the Beanie Babies. It was linked to the, like, I don't know what you would want to call it, the mania around the internet. Because Beanie Babies, even though they're a physical item, so much of what made their market grow a lot in the early days was they were very innovative about online. Like, they had information about all their toys online. Like, because, you know, Beanie Babies would have a name and they'd have a poem. Like, you could find out more about your particular character online. There was community that would basically gather around that. There were more Beanie Baby fan forums. There was more, you know, Beanie Babies transacted online than there was for, like, any other toy at the time. Beanie Babies were more than 10% of eBay's revenue when eBay went public in 98. So, like, it's a huge online component of that. But it's a easier to grasp thing, to your point, than like, you know, trying to get early stock in some company you never heard of. So it's like, it's tied to that era of unrealistic expectations about what the internet could do. Like there's a possibility the internet could just revolutionize everything in such a positive way. And, you know, that clearly wasn't quite meant to be.
Let's move on to Pocket Monsters. And okay. where does Pokemon come from? And how do, because Pokemon's a bit different. One, it's for children. I mean, Beanie Babies are for children, but the investors clearly weren't. And my sense is that at least at the time, there wasn't as much adult participation in like the Pokemon trading card
market.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
Like there might occur. So like, what are Pokemon? Where do they come from? And how do they relate to this story of acquisitive capitalism? I guess teaching children, got to catch them all.
Yeah. Well, Pokemon, they're from Japan and they make their North American debut in 1999 across every media format. I mean, Pokemon has a cartoon at that time. They have five of the top 10 best-selling video games in the U.S. They have a movie that hits North American theaters in 99 that does very well. Their trading cards are a huge smash hit. They basically are the biggest thing in the card business since like Topps baseball in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, kids are trying to consume this franchise. They're trying to like be a part of this franchise in every little facet. So like if you're a Pokemon fan, you know, it wasn't enough to just like have some toys. Like to gotta catch them all, you know, you needed to like have the Game Boy game and the anime and the cards. And a lot of franchises do this now, but Pokemon did this exceptionally well to the point where there was a bit of a panic in some like journalism quarters. Like Newsweek and Time both ran cover stories in the same month saying how you know, Pokemon is this huge scheme that's going to like deprave parents. The headline of the Newsweek article is Pokemon evil? You know, I mean, clearly they're a little bit tongue in cheek, but like it gives you a sense of just how big the franchise was. And what I saw in Pokemon though was a little bit more of like the endemic nature of capitalism. You know, Beanie Babies is the excesses, like the booms and the busts. Pokemon didn't have as big of a boom or as big of a bust. They just continued to be around producing more and more shit that no one needs, but that people like to consume. You know, because then you have Pokemon Go, now you have Pokemon Sleep. There's like a new app centered around the Pokemon experience, basically every few years. And they're a franchise that's just a big part of pop culture now. Like Pokemon, you know, Beanie Babies aren't really as popular now the way they were in the 90s. You can still find them, but it's more of a nostalgic thing. Whereas Pokemon, like those games still sell well. They're still making movies that are in theaters.
They're still printing money in a real way.
Oh, for sure. And they will be for probably, you know, another few decades. It's a huge IP that isn't going anywhere. And just the catchphrase, gotta catch them all. I mean, that's just basically like capitalism, like that's consumerism. It's the perfect motto for it. It's so perfect that some scholars have said that it was a marketing coup that they were allowed to do it because FCC rules used to prohibit marketing that type of direct consumption to kids.
Yeah, like that's all of Saturday morning cartoons and like they're all play action figures. Like
When Reagan deregulated advertising allotments in the 80s, that's when you had Masters of the Universe and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and G.I. Joe, where action figures became the IP that you would build a show around that wasn't even legal before Reagan because you had restrictions on how many ad minutes you could have in an hour for a TV network. And these shows are entirely an ad. Like, you know, it's 30 minutes of advertising per hour. So you needed that deregulation for something like Pokemon to even exist. It's like the purest distillation of unrestrained capitalism.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Let's move on to wrestling. Of everything in the book, this has probably been written about the most. With this concept of kayfabe and the idea that everyone knows what they're saying is fake, but there's also reality to it, but there's also a falseness to it. So what do you think that 1999, adding the temporal aspect here, helps us understand about the relationship between the pro wrestling kayfabe culture and what's going on in this beautiful country of ours?
Well, in 99, that's when pro wrestling popularity peaked. So WWE, WCW, they're both going really strong at the time, even though WCW is a little bit on the decline. But to give you a sense of just how popular it was, they were airing over 10 hours of TV every week, watched by about 30 million Americans, which is just, you know, crazy, crazy big. They were embedded in all sorts of pop culture. It was in the 90s that wrestling became, a lot more sexualized, more violent. And it's where, like, a lot of the era's biggest stars have thrived and continue to thrive. You know, Vince McMahon became a billionaire in 99. WWE became public in 99. The bump that they got at that time is responsible for where they are now in national politics. I mean, Linda McMahon is on pace to gut the Department of Education, most likely. It's tough to imagine her being in that position if wrestling didn't continue to just get more and more popular during the 90s. But beyond that, just my point, like you said, it's been written about a lot, is just that this kayfabe is everywhere now. Wrestling helped popularize it, especially in 99. But at this point, you see all sorts of organizations selling a story that doesn't quite make sense on its own, but it makes sense as part of a broader storyline. Just one brief example, like the continual outrage over football superstar Travis Kelce for taking money from Anheuser-Busch InBev to do commercials. That's something every NFL star has done. Bud Light's been one of the largest advertisers of football my whole life. But now that they once did a marketing campaign with a transgender influencer, that deems them unredeemable to a big part of the population. And so when a football player does an ad campaign with them, they're tarred and feathered as if they're the Iron Sheik in the 80s. But it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense on its own. Like, every athlete would take that money. But now he's a culture warrior for doing a commercial advertisement for a multinational corporation that is just hell-bent on making profits and cutting taxes. So that's kind of the crazy world we live in. But you see that sort of nonsensical storytelling all over, especially if you're looking for it.
One thing that I did want to bring up before we move on is this notion of rewriting history, which was to me new, this sort of editing and rewriting of wrestling history. Could you talk a bit about what literally happened and how you think that relates to the world?
Well, yeah. So part of the kayfabe that WWE was so successful in the 90s isn't just like telling you that Ultimate Warrior is from parts unknown, or you know, he's selling you these, you know, crazy stories about Mankind and The Undertaker. It's the revisionism they apply to their own story and to their competition. So, like WWE, there are so many times that they will say that they did something one way, but the record shows the complete opposite. Just to give one example, if you take The Ultimate Warrior, they hated The Ultimate Warrior when they split up. They produced this documentary trashing him, saying how terrible he was. But then he died. They removed that documentary from circulation. It's not on the WWE Network. They made a new documentary, and it's all like about this loving tribute and how he was like this great guy, even though he's absolutely crazy in real life. If you ever look up The Ultimate Warrior, And they just do a 180 and act like what they said before didn't matter at all. Like they didn't even say it before, that the official record of WWE is like, the Warrior was great. He was always great. We didn't have a 15-year period where we defamed him. It's a lot like J.D. Vance's relationship with Donald Trump. He called him Hitler in private. He said he was a Never Trump guy. That was his whole spiel after Hillbilly Elegy, that he was this like Never Trumper conservative. He was the rational type conservative. He's not going to go to these crazy directions that Trump does. Well, now look at him. He's done exactly what WWE did with the Warrior. He pretends that doesn't exist, and the only record that there is of J.D. Vance and Donald Trump is the one of him just habitually kissing his ass forever. And WWE does a good job of like taking some of the worst aspects of its past and just kind of burying them from the official record and hoping you never forget. And it's just silly wrestling. So like most people would say, who the hell cares? But I would argue that's why Vince McMahon got away with such despicable behavior for a long time, in a way that execs of other entertainment agencies, when that was brought to light, they were removed much quicker than he was. When it's viewed as frivolous and silly, and he has an iron fist over it, you can get away with it longer. No one's questioning it.
Yeah, let's talk about the Insane Clown Posse. Yeah, what do they call your juggalo, right? So who are these guys and where do they come from? I think a lot of internet brain people will know them from that Miracles song that went really, really popular. And there was definitely, to me, an element of making fun of working class people. And so I think we've actually been through a cycle with ICP where people were making fun of them, but then people were criticized for making fun of them because it was so clearly like middle class to upper middle class to rich people making fun of like essentially Midwest working class culture. But maybe you could talk a little bit about where these guys came from and why they're actually worthy of study.
And I agree with what you're saying totally. Over the last 10 years, the way ICP is portrayed is like been from just they're the worst band of all time, they make the worst albums of the year, to now like they're fighting up, they're standing up for the First Amendment by protesting against the FBI lawsuit, and they're actually heroes to the underclass. We should welcome ICP. It's been quite the journey. But ICP, for the uninitiated, they're a duo of rappers from Detroit. They paint their face like clowns. They have a bunch of albums that are part of this concept.
Shaggy, Too Dope, and Violent J, I believe, are their names.
That's exactly their names. Right. Yep, Violent J and Shaggy, Too Dope. Their albums are about these carnival characters that do all sorts of murder and sex acts and a lot of silly shit that like 13-year-old boys find funny. I certainly found funny when I was a young kid. But what I find interesting about them, why I wrote about them, and it's not just because they were more popular in 99 than they ever had been before. I mean, they had 2 platinum records by the end of that year. Before, they were only selling 10,000 a month. It's that they've so perfected the idea of being an outsider. Like to get your followers to band along and so they will like, if you're a juggalo, you are down with the clowns for life. Like you're not just like kind of into ICP, you are super into them. Like, and your friends come from that group. You find meaning in your life through not just their music, but through other fans of their music. And they've done all this by marketing themselves a lot like a way a religious group would. Like, it's a lot of us versus them. The secular world doesn't understand you. Fuck the world. I mean, that's actually like probably the most streamed song from their 1999 album is Fuck the World. They have a great tendency to bring together self-perceived outsiders. And then like the music is just the soundtrack of them being together. So it's like a congregation that just happens to be a band that I find super fascinating. And the way they talk about the outside world casting spells on them, it's just the way my Catholic priest talked about the outside world, all through college. ICP isn't pushing an agenda. I wouldn't call them culture warriors or anything, but they've like done such a great job of getting people to identify and belong with them that other groups could learn a lot from.
What do you think it is in youth culture that, what gap were they filling? How did they go from selling 10,000 to 2 million records? What is happening over the course of the 1990s that allows them to explode? Of course, there is Eminem, another Detroit area rapper who is coming up around this time. And they, of course, had a beef. Eminem, very much embraced by the musical establishment. Insane Clown Posse, very much not embraced. And so is that just because Eminem is doing this type of social realism that elite critics generally like, and ICP is essentially doing just a ton of concept albums? And then what is ICP tapping into in youth culture that allows them to like genuinely explode in a way 99.99% of bands never do?
They play on their notoriety, like their notoriety monsters over their success. That's how Violent J puts it. Part of the way, the reason that they get so big is they have a dispute with Disney, where Disney boots them. Disney, they were on an album label, a record label owned by Disney in 1997 for the Great Malenko, and Disney kicked them off before the album ever got released. It was part of this boycott that Southern Baptists were doing to Disney of publishing indecent material, and one of the things Disney cleansed itself of was ICP, and that gave the band so much press and like goodwill from fans. They go from being like someone no one had heard of to like being a news story for quite a while in 97 and 98 because they're the little guy fighting against the man, who they were unfairly discriminated against by Disney. And they just kind of continue to play that track. Like they continue to do a great job of like playing on people hate us, therefore like you're with us if people hate you too. So like one little thing they did is their record label bought airtime on MTV. MTV used to auction off some airtime as part of a charity, and ICP bought like an hour of airtime. And what they did with their airtime is they released this self-made documentary, and the documentary is mostly just people shitting on ICP. Like it's like people on the street saying how like they're a menace and they're terrible and they don't know anything about music. They're using that to market themselves. They're not like using, you know, they're not like gonna make a documentary where they're gonna have people from Spin and Vibe magazine talk about how great ICP is. The way they market themselves is like, look at these people mocking us the way they're mocking you. And that has proven to be very powerful over a long period of time. You don't appeal to everyone, but the fans that they did appeal to, they have them forever.
Let's talk about everyone's favorite topic, and that is pornography. So maybe you could give us a sense of where porn was in the 1990s and why 99 is a crucial year for it.
Well, in the 90s, porn is it's getting more popular and more distributed than ever due to the emergence of the internet. You know, it's behind so many new e-commerce technologies, whether that's like credit card transactions or cookies or video chat. It's pioneering much of the modern internet, and it's becoming a thing that people can access in their homes very easily without having to go through a middleman like they had in the past, whether that was a gas station or a peep show or whatever. So porn, as it's becoming more popular, it's producing anxieties about the internet. There are attempts to regulate online speech using porn as the culprit. The most famous is the 1996 Communication Decency Act, pushed by James Exon. And there are several other court cases that happened, including one in 99 involving Playboy at the Supreme Court, where porn reigns victorious. Like, for the late 90s and early 2000s, all these free speech cases, whether it was online or TV, come against the porn industry, and they win, and it expands rights to all sorts of other media outlets that aren't porn outlets, you know, and those laws are still in place right now, and they're under duress due to, all these attempts to take down Section 230 and all these age consent laws around porn viewing. But in 99, there's other things in the culture that are porn adjacent that are really popular. Like Viagra makes it's his first full year in the public market, and it grosses over $1 billion, and its ads are just inescapable. Girls Gone Wild's like everywhere, especially if you're watching TV after 1 a.m. There are competitions around the country on who can masturbate the longest, who can have sex with the most number of people. I don't know how to explain it other than the rules of decency were being relaxed a little bit. And as more cable stations emerged and the internet got more popular, there were more places where you could put porn legally. But it's something that produced a lot of contention then, just like it does now. It was at the heart of like every serious media law case of the late 90s.
Do you think that this could have happened in any year? If just the internet came in 2005, it would have been the same thing? Or is there something peculiar at between the end of the Cold War and 9/11 that made porn such a center of how people thought about politics and culture? And I mean, it's still a lightning rod, but it's not a lightning rod like it was.
Probably not like it was.
Yeah, I feel like people just kind of accept it, all across the political spectrum, people accept porn as normative in a way that seems less true of the 1990s. Like people would make fun of the guy going to the beaded section of the adult of the video store, mm-hmm. The adults only section. So what do you think it was about the 90s? Is this sort of, the boomers really heading into middle age, the greatest generation really dying out? There's more a sexual revolution. Ideas are now more mainstream. What do you think is happening in 99?
Well, I would say it's the internet. So if the internet emerged later, let's say the internet emerges, 10 years later, like 2005, like you were saying as an example, then these debates probably happen then. Because every time there's a new media format or a new form of technology, especially one that's primarily uptake by young people, there is condemnation and attempts to regulate it. So, what the internet was going through then, porn is like a proxy used to attack the internet because it's the thing that the least amount of people are going to object to you trying to censor. But porn was like when movies first came out, anything that was sexual received a lot of heat. Same with early video games. I mean, any media that comes out receives that anxiety, and porn already produces that anxiety. So when you have porn online for old people in the 90s, that's terrifying. But I think a lot of the porn phobia was actually technophobia, but I could be wrong.
In what sense? People were worried about their lives being placed online and for display?
Well, I don't even know if they were at that point yet, because social media didn't really exist yet. It was more, what are the kids going to consume? Like, how are we going to stop them from accessing all the worst stuff imaginable? The porn is just, Time had this story and it ended up being debunked. It was how like 85% of online images were porn, and like all the search terms are porn. And it was based off of a faulty study done by an undergraduate. But that was, that study took off because it spoke to a fear that people had with the internet. Like, what would it be used for? How can you protect young people from it? You kind of see the same thing with boomers now and TikTok. Obviously, it's not about porn, but like there's such an anxiety about a form of communication that they don't understand. And so that's, I think, why porn got roped into so many of those free speech cases, because other material could have prompted those cases. But it did not.
Let's conclude with video games. And this might be a useful place to talk about Columbine, because I remember I was a freshman in high school, and this was really the discussion about, did Doom cause Columbine, which of course happened in April 1999. So what was the state of video games in the late 1990s? What were the discussions around them? And what did they reveal about the culture at the time, or our culture today?
Yeah,
really?
Well, in 1999, when Columbine happened, video games were becoming popular, but they weren't like they are now. They were getting to that point of becoming a more mature entertainment medium. So PlayStation 1 which came out in the mid-90s, was the first console to sell 100 million units. Games had been primarily consumed by young people in the 80s, not exclusively, but the games were a little tamer. They weren't as good in graphics. Now, as gamers start to age and the average age of gamers goes up, you see more mature games and they're reaching more people than ever before, but they're also being used as a scapegoat for all sorts of crimes. Columbine's the most famous, but there's all kinds of issues where video games come in the 90s and are you know, blamed for a suicide or a shooting or what have you. And it wasn't just the press doing it or just parents. There was academic cottage industry that sprung up where all these studies started to surface right after Columbine that were showing video games are linked to aggression and aggression is linked to violence. And, you know, therefore we need to temper down video games and censor them for young people. And the games industry was scared for its life. Like a lot of the sessions at E3, which was the largest expo for video games for many years, were canceled. They wouldn't take requests from the media. Some games toned down their graphics or their storylines even. And they continued to be a scapegoat for quite a while until basically they've become the most popular entertainment format in the world, or at least most financially successful. Games make more than movies, music, and films combined. And that pressure's kind of come off because now they're, you know, the average age is a 35-year-old and people understand that more. But in the 90s, the argument was that, like, games are so real. The PlayStation 1 graphics are so realistic that a teenager who's playing Doom or Mortal Kombat, they don't know fantasy from real life. When they're, you know, shooting someone in this first person shooter on PlayStation 1, that's teaching them to do it in their real life because it's so immersive. And you know, we just can't even tell what is real and what isn't with these young people who are so addicted to games. It's kind of like the technophobia, you know, that you had with the internet. But it's hard to recall now because I feel like video games are considered relatively tame outside of, you know, a few titles, but I don't, there's no congressional hearings about them right now, but there were several in the 90s. I mean, there were attempts to censor Night Trap, and that's a game that's rated T for teen now when they released the 25th anniversary edition. But with games, what we saw, though, a lot of the criticism was people who weren't familiar with them, and you would see that come out in the hearings. So like when there was a hearing on Night Trap, they kept describing Night Trap as this game where you would go around the house murdering young women. And they would show these scenes where young women were like, they'd have their blood drained by these like robot looking vampire dudes. I don't even know what you'd call them other than monsters. And that they wouldn't disclose is like, your whole point in that game is to stop those monsters from draining those women. And you know, you're supposed to protect the women. You're trying to save them. They show the cutscene when you fuck up and you fail, and then you end the level. That's what you're trying to avoid. But that all that context was flattened when games were attacked in the 90s. They would just show clips of like the most violent act you could do in Doom or Night Trap and say like, this is coming for your kids. You know, these kids used to be so innocent. Now this happened and they're going to be blamed for it. It's a convenient scapegoat to project the blame onto, you know, something other than gun access.
Yeah, it's just like there's a lot of technophobia, I think, just due to the rise of the internet, and the internet really engenders this total rethinking of society, because it obviously, there was some sense that it was going to reshape society, and indeed it did. But to wrap up here, so what do you think 1999 has to teach us in 2025? Just overall, we talked about these very specific things, but what should people understand about 1999? How does it foreshadow where we are today? And what do we do going forward, if anything?
Wow. Recommendations are always tough, but what it shows is just that the trashiest stuff that we liked as kids, that was popular a quarter century ago, still resonates in our society in a powerful way. So like, you know, you can mock Jerry Springer and pro wrestling and porn and say it's terrible for the culture and all, and that's your own opinion. But we shouldn't just be totally dismissive of lowbrow entertainment, because it's very influential and millions of people are consuming this stuff. It has lasting effects, and those effects are still with us. Now, as far as takeaways, I wouldn't say all these things are bad necessarily. Like, I don't think reality TV becoming more popular and influencers embracing reality TV is necessarily terrible, because there's a lot of people who have a voice now, whether that's, you know, through their own reality show or through their Facebook or TikTok or whatever, who wouldn't have otherwise. You know, some of the gatekeeping being flattened does present more people to get their ideas out who would have been blocked by a gatekeeper before. But, you know, that's one small positive in a room full of a lot of dark light right now.
That's pretty good. Let's end on that positive note. Russ Bennis, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone check out 1999, the year low culture conquered America and kickstarted our bizarre times. Thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, thank you.